Hi folks, welcome to the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters, episode 61, The Anglo-Saxons. I'm joined by Beau, and we're going to be discussing the Anglo-Saxon invasion of Britain. If we can even call it an invasion, really.
I was going to say invasions,
invasions,
probably.
Yeah, in a way. But I mean, if I guess the legendary history is true, then it's kind of invited in as well, so...
Right, yeah. So you're talking about Hengist and Horsa right there.
Yeah, yeah.
Voltigern and that whole thing. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, who knows? You know, this period of history is murky because a lot of the people involved weren't literate and didn't write anything down. Mm. So we have oral traditions to go on.
Well, maybe that's a good place to start, the actual historiography of it.
Yes.
Because we've got, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle doesn't go back all that far.
Mm-hmm.
But so we've got Gildas, Bede, and a couple of other bits and bobs, the Historica Britonum, there's a Cambrian annal. So there's little bits and bobs.
Yeah.
But the fact that it's called the Dark Ages is fair enough, because once the Romans leave in 410, you know, it's not all on one day, but essentially once they leave, there's not many literate peoples left. Certainly the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes didn't really write anything down.
No, they've got better things to do.
Yeah, yeah, they're basically illiterate, yeah.
Yeah.
So it is a bit darkened, I'm afraid. But I think that it's good and bad. It's mostly bad, because as a historian, you want to know as much as possible, right?
Yeah.
But it's good in the sense that, in a limited sense, that it's sort of a bit more romantic, really. You can fill in the details, and you get just like the odd line here and there, which is kind of ambiguous.
Mm.
And, well, that's interesting. I mean, it's also frustrating for people that just want to know what actually happened. But
the thing is, it seems that we will never know what actually happened. So all we can really do is extract from the archaeology and see how that tracks to the myths.
Mm. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, where to begin? I suppose the best, where we did the last one, last epoch, was about Alfred the Great.
Mm.
This one, we're going to do the whole of the Anglo-Saxons. So it's a big chunk of time, 500-600 odd years, depending on exactly how you measure it. And so we've actually bitten off a big chunk here.
Yeah.
So I'd like everyone to know that we are going to whip through it a bit. And next time we'll zoom in on probably Athelstan, the grandson of Alfred the Great. So a bit more zoomed in. I did actually want to say to people out there, if you have any comments or feedback, if you prefer, you know, zoomed in things, because sometimes we did sort of like maybe the Nikkei rites, it's just a few days there, isn't it?
Mm.
And then this is hundreds of years, and we've done things that are extremely broad and things that are quite focused. And I wonder if people have got any sort of feelings on whether they prefer
any
one way or the other.
Yeah.
But this one will be fairly sort of zoomed out, quite high level overview.
Mm.
But then hopefully that will put the Athelstan one in a bit more context and things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Beginning with 410, that's sort of the date. Mentioned some of this in the Alfred the Great one, but Churchill said, by the beginning of the 5th century, all the legions had gone on one errand or another, and to frantic appeals for aid, the helpless Emperor Honorius could only send his valedictory message in 410 that, quote, the cantons, or the provinces, should take steps to defend themselves, just that.
Yeah, look to your own defence.
Yeah.
And that can't have been good news.
Now, people say, historians, I was reading, was it Mark Morris, or a modern historian, saying that they had a thing basically called a villa culture, whereas the Romans had, full cities and things, all sorts of cities and military encampments and all sorts of things. But it seems that the real civil society, or most of the culture, if you like, most of the Latin culture, resided in grand villas dotted all around the countryside.
Yeah.
Because town centres were sort of dirty.
Grim,
yeah.
Like they are now.
Disease. And if you can afford to live in a giant palatial villa set in your own grounds, then people do. And anyway, apparently that culture, that sort of way of living, lasted deep into the 5th century.
Right.
Okay. Everyone didn't just go home in 410.
Mm.
The legions did, or had already, actually, by 410. But that's interesting to note, that this sort of... the way of living, or the Romanization. If you ever study Roman Britain or did a course on it, undergrad or anything like that, they always talk about what degree to which Romanization took hold, and whether it was sort of very deep, or it was just a surface level. Was it only sort of masterclass?
Or seems to be very deep.
Relatively, yeah. They took on wearing togas and things.
Yeah.
So like,
which kind of been pleasant with British weather.
Mm.
You know, it's fine in Italy, but maybe in southern France. But like, you know, when you get, you're getting to sort of like Northumbria, it's like, really, you're wearing a toga in winter?
Yeah.
Possibly not.
Right, yeah. So though we've got sort of maybe mosaics or tapestries or things showing that, I get you can, big historians argue over how, it's difficult to know, well, it's impossible to know, isn't it, really? But I, personally, I love going to a ruined Roman villa.
Oh, yeah, there, and there are loads around. I went to one on the Isle of Wight. It's wonderful. But so the villa culture, I think, is interesting because the you can see that these are a product of security. If you have legions marching around on the frontiers, then yes, you can have lots. You've got vast areas of space that are in productive land, and it's safe generally. And so, yeah, you can have villas without barbarian hordes wandering by and pillaging them. But the thing is, as soon as those legions aren't the guarantor of the peace, this culture tends to change because suddenly the barbarian hordes come wandering back, which is probably what the post-Roman Britons discovered.
Yeah, well, no, that's absolutely it. If you're left undefended, it's not a problem unless you're invaded by, until you find sort of an implacable, sort of ultra-violent enemy.
Well, they don't even have to be necessarily implacable, just, you know, it, because for the barbarians, the Roman Empire would have been something over there that's been there for a long time, and it's dangerous. And when they start discovering, well, hang on a second, there's no one defending this prosperous island, well, then why don't we just go over there and, you know, take some of their stuff? And then they get back. And then, look at this Roman gold we've got. So where'd you get that? Oh, that island. There's no one there. And so you can see how the sort of like magnetic attraction of their wealth draws in, like much like with the Anglo-Saxons and the Vikings, in fact. If there's a poorly defended island with lots of money over there, yeah, there is. You should have learned a lesson, shouldn't you? Frankly.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. It's not lost on historians.
No.
That the Viking invasions that we talked about last time mirror from a different direction, but they very much mirror the invasions of the Anglos, Anglo-Saxons and Jutes of hundreds of years previous. Yeah, no, absolutely.
So you can see why the villa culture ended as well, because it's just not safe. You just can't do it.
Yeah. What we do get is the odd sort of cache of treasure, buried treasure that we find, dates from usually sort of the early to mid 5th century, where the last gasp of these villa cultures, they knew that a barbarian horde was coming their way, so they buried all their valuables, all their gold. And it speaks volumes that it was never dug up again.
Well, yeah, obviously in the hope that the barbarians would come, pillage, leave, and then they'd be able to get it. And as you say, they never went back for it for some reason.
Well, they'll have been killed, haven't they? I mean, probably. To be left to or be enslaved. Buried for 1,500 year or near until some archaeologist digs it up. So that speaks volumes. But if I could, I'm going to have a quick overview of the next 100 years or more. Mm-hmm. And it's not just because I'm being lazy, because that's what all historians have to do, more or less.
Because there's not really anything in great detail.
Yeah, right. We've got, it's really fragmentary. So those that try and argue that at least sort of the 5th and 6th centuries aren't a dark age, they're wrong.
Are here.
Yeah, right here.
Okay, maybe not in the Islamic world or the Byzantine world. Exactly. Not pre-Islamic, sorry. But, you know, the Byzantine world, sure. But over here, nobody really knew what was going on.
Yeah, no, that's right. It seems to be shrouded in, I mean, even King Arthur, who's supposed to be 5th, very early 6th century, it's not true. It's not right. It's not real history.
Well, no, it's a legend.
Right. And doesn't that speak volumes that you're able to do that? Conjure something from sort of thin air, really, Geoffrey of Monmouth in the 12th century.
So just to touch on the King Arthur thing, I actually spent quite a lot of time reading all the King Arthur legends and studying the history of it, or purported history. And it is likely that the figure who is Arthur, it is derived from some sort of Celto-Latin word, something like that. Apparently the root of it is bear. Right. So, okay, fine. You know, arts is bear, apparently.
Okay.
Exactly. I didn't know this until I looked into it. I've never heard that. And so it is likely that there was some, you know, 5th century post-Roman leader who organized some sort of militia that won a battle against the Anglo-Saxon invaders. That is probable. You know, it seems like a sure. likely...
And absolutely that.
You know, and so this, the legend of King Arthur appears to have sprung from that, which...
Yeah.
But we don't have any details on it, really. And so...
Yeah, no, absolutely. It seems that King Arthur is probably a bit like Robin Hood or Jesus.
Yeah.
An amalgam of more than one person, actually.
Quite possibly.
Probably. But we just don't know. The history isn't really there. Well, we're on Arthur. We as well. I've got a quick line from Oman. He said this, gradually pushing onwards along the ridges. I was talking about the Angles and the Saxons. Gradually pushing onwards along the ridges of the Downs, successive generations of the kings of Wessex drove the Britons out of Dorsetshire and Wiltshire till the line of conquest stopped at the Forest Belt, which lay east of Bath. Here the advance is still for a time, for the British kings of the Damonians, the tribe of Devon and Cornwall, made a most obstinate defence. So gallant was it that the Celts of a later generation believed that the legendary hero of their race, the great King Arthur, had headed the hosts of Damnonia in person and placed the city of Camelot and his grave at Avalon within the compass of the Western realm.
Mm.
But people that know their history know that Geoffrey of Monmouth, hundreds and hundreds of years after, well, what is he, the 12th century, essentially made it all up.
Yeah.
All the details about Uther Pendragon and yes, Guinevere.
It's all
nonsense.
But the interesting thing about it is Arthur's become like an English hero, but the English are the villains in the story. And so it's like, you know, how this just goes to show you the complete lack of veracity of any historical detail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you read on the medieval... poems about Arthur, and they're just, you know, he's an English king as far as they're concerned. So that doesn't make any sense. You know, he's at war with Rome. That doesn't make any sense. None of it makes sense.
Well, like Theseus, the chronology is just all kinds of warped.
Yeah, yeah. It's not real.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Well, he was reimagined sort of in the age of Edward.
Oh, yeah.
The first and, well, sorry, Edward III mainly, the Round Table and all of that is sort of reimagined. But it's great stuff anyway, even if it is sort of fictional, just like Robin Hood. Well, okay, so moving on from Arthur.
The Robin Hood thing is probably more reality to be honest.
Yeah, well, that's funny. Well, just very briefly talk about that. It was I was listening to a thing the other day where they were saying that you can find original accounts of a Robin Hood type figure.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes he's based in Nottingham, sometimes it's nowhere near there, and sometimes it's from the days of King John, which is what we're used to. Sometimes there's much later
and sometimes
versions.
There's an earlier... There was one... again, I looked into this as well. There was an account of... I can't remember which king it was, but he had a robin in his court. And one of the Robin Hood legends is basically, you know, he gets... accepted after the fall of King John or something like that. He gets accepted back into the power structure. You know, he's legitimized. You know, oh, you were resisting an illegitimate king and therefore you're a legitimate, you know, rebel. You did the right thing. And it's all a moral story rather than like, you know, proper history. But it may have been based on someone, you know, who, you know, it's entirely likely.
Oh,
but like with Jesus, I'm afraid, you know, lots of people called Jesus, lots of people called Robin, it doesn't mean that the stories are true. Anyway.
Because the hood is just an outlaw, any outlaw.
Yeah.
So was there a guy who lived in the forest as an outlaw at some point in... Yes,
yeah.
Certainly.
But was there a famous one called Robin who was well-liked by the peasants? Probably.
And was friends with a friar, Tuck, and all that sort of thing. Yeah, John Little. Who knows? That's...
But it's not unbelievable.
No, right.
You know, it's totally plausible that there is a small group of outlaws and... these were the names, and then a bunch of stories grew up around them, you know. Totally plausible. But anyway.
So, yeah, a little aside on Robin Hood.
Yeah.
Robin
getting
the
a bit
Hood
off topic.
So, to say that the next 150 odd years after the Romans leave, you get...
chaos.
Bit of chaos, yeah. If I could read a paragraph here from Churchill, who said, another 12 years passed after another period he was talking about, and a Gaulish chronicler records this sombre note in AD 441, or possibly 442, and they said, the Britons in these days, by all kinds of calamities and disasters, are falling into the power of the Saxons. Churchill continues, what happened? Something more than the forays of the 4th century. The mass migration from northern Germany had begun. Thereafter, the darkness closed in. Upon this darkness, we have four windows, each obstructed by dim or coloured glass. First, we have the tracks of Gildas, upon whom the gratitude of the Middle Ages bestowed the title of the Wise. The tract was written in approximately 545, and therefore 100 years after this curtain fell between Britannia and the continent. Nearly 200 years later, the Venerable Bede, whose main theme was the history of the English Church, lets fall some precious scraps of information outside his subject about the settlement itself, i.e. politics of the land itself. A compilation known as the Historica Britonum contains some documents earlier than Bede. Finally, in the 9th century, and very likely at the direction of King Alfred, various annals preserved in different monasteries were put together as the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. Checking these by each other, and by such certainties as archaeology allows us to entertain, we have the following picture. Imitating a common Roman practice, the dominant British chief, about 450, sought to strengthen himself by bringing in a band of mercenaries from overseas. They proved a trap. Once the road was open, fresh fleet loads made their way across and up the rivers from the Humber, perhaps as far round as Portsmouth. But the British resistance stiffened as the invaders got away from the coast, and their advance was brought to a standstill for nearly 50 years by a great battle won at Mount Badon. So there's a fair bit there, but
yeah,
there's basically it's all shrouded in sort of semi-myth. So mentioned there the battle at Mount Badon. We don't know where that is. It's actually probably quite near here.
Yeah, possibly, yeah.
They think, Lidington, a little small place called Lidington?
There are lots of places where it's potentially Mount Badon, but it was 1,500 years ago and no one knows.
Well, Churchill says, might be exaggerating, I don't know, but he said 100 scholarly endeavours have tried to find Mount Badon, and none of them have succeeded, sort of lost.
But what's interesting, though, is, okay, why do the Britons need mercenaries? And that's because Hadrian's Wall is no longer being policed. And above Hadrian's Wall, you have the Picts, who are not the Scottish. The Scots came over from Ireland in about 300 years' time or something. Well, no, in that sort of time period. The same sort of time period as the Anglo-Saxons are settling what becomes England. The Irish Scots come over and start settling what becomes Scotland. It's very interesting how you get these migrations from two sides. But the Picts decide they're going to go down and start invading. And
well, that's right. We get some of the first details are about Kent. Mm. And the ruler of Kent was being invaded by the Picts and the Scots.
Yeah.
In Kent.
Yeah.
So as far south as you can get, really, almost, you know.
Yeah, from where they started.
Far southeast, anyway. That ruler just couldn't seem to handle it. What was his name? Vortigern?
Yeah, Vortigern.
Yeah. So he asks over some Saxons, Hengist and Horsa are their names. And there's, again, even those figures are sort of semi-fictional. Again, the word likely, you have to use the word likely.
Or possible.
Or possibly, yeah. And it's fair enough to do that. I mean, if you
I don't even know if it's likely, but I mean,
it is likely they're real, but we can't definitely say.
Because they were brothers, weren't they?
Probably. Kinsmen. Kinsmen.
Yeah. But so Horsa means just horse, doesn't it?
I suppose it does, yeah. I don't really know the etymology of it.
I remember reading about these a while ago, and they both got like very barbarian sounding names, you know, like they're very unsophisticated. And it's just fascinating. But obviously, being Germanic barbarians compared to the Romans, these are glorious warriors, you know, these are terrifying, you know, like the Romans at this point were Christians, and the pagan barbarians still, you know, adhere to the morality of the poetic sagas. So it's, you know, these people live and dream heroism and are like very in the moment, whereas the Christians are much more placid and think of an afterlife and think of like things in the future and, you know, after their own time and things like that. And that's just not how the sort of the pagan people look at the world. And it manifests in their behavior. You know, they're total savages as far as the Romans are concerned, and rightly so.
Mm. That's absolutely it. Because they're definitely not Christian.
No, absolutely not.
The story of how and when they become Christian is sort of fairly well documented, or we know about that in some detail. So the very first ones, the Hengist and Horsa types, are certainly pagans.
Yeah.
The Christian world it's already sort of fairly organized. There's like popes in Rome, with bishoprics,
and there have been for hundreds of years,
right? Yeah, so that is sort of important to remember, I think, to bear in mind. Okay, another quick line here from Churchill, the birth of Britain. He said, "The history books of our childhood attempted courageously to prescribe exact dates for all the main events. In 499, Hengist and Horsa, invited by Vortigern, founded the Jutish kingdom in Kent upon the corpses of its former inhabitants. In 477, Ella and his three sons arrived to continue the inroad. In 495... Cerdic and Seinric appeared. In 501, Pult the pirate founded Portsmouth. In 514, the West Saxons, Stuf and Witigar, descended in their turn and put the Britons to flight. In 544, Witigar was killed. In 547 came Ida, founder of the Kingdom of Northumberland. All that can be said around these dates." I've written that out wrong.
"All that can be said."
"All that can be said about these dates is that they correspond broadly to the facts, and that these successive waves of invaders, bringing behind them settlers, descended on our unhappy shores." End quote.
Yeah.
So again, I'm not just whipping through that for the sake of it. Mm. There's not much like Ida.
Who's that?
Right. So what we can really just say is that there's waves of these Angles and Saxons and Jutes, and they're all from the same place, roughly in Germany, Saxony. Mm. Schleswig-Holstein, that's the area they're
just
all from.
The sort of northwest curve of Germany as it goes into Denmark. It's basically where they all come from. What I find interesting, again, it's very quick, isn't it? You know, it's, you know, a decade between, 15 years, sort of, you know, so less than a generation is the young men of Saxony and northern Germany are just like, yeah, well, let's go over to Britain. You know, there's something going on in Britain, and then a new generation of young men and a new generation of young men, you know, so these are adventurous. But what I find really interesting is the original legend of Hengist and Horsa being invited in by Vortigern. As I recall, Vortigern, as you say, was like, well, I'm being attacked by Picts. I need some strong barbarian mercenaries. And then the legend says that Vortigern refused to pay them. Now, how true that is, who knows, obviously. But that's not very wise, is it, Vortigern? You know, these are your warriors.
Yeah.
Like, why not just pay them? Mm. Just pay them. And, of course, after not... This is the Saxon story of how it was legitimate that they took over Britain, because they got double-crossed by the deceitful Vortigern after doing all the dirty work for him, and then were like, okay, well, we're just going to take over then. Mm. And that was the moral justification that they gave.
Mm. So the story goes that Hengist and Horsa, for whatever reason, whether they were paid or not, at the end of their terms of service, if you like, after they'd done what they'd gone to do, i.e. shore up Vortigern's position, he was like, thanks very much.
Yeah.
See you later now, guys. And they're like, we're not going anywhere, bro. You've buggered up. We're not going anywhere.
And
they turn on him, take it over, and Kent becomes...
Yeah.
Their kingdom.
But, I mean, they did successfully fight off the Picts, so they did their part.
Right. You know? Yeah, I mean, you can't really argue with it. In a world where might is right, there's no arguing with it.
Especially if Vortigern didn't pay them.
Right.
That seems really silly.
Horsa gets himself killed in a battle fairly quickly, but Hengist goes on to become sort of the king of Kent, if you like.
The first.
One of them, I think Horsa settles on Thanet, which is Nigel Farage's seat, isn't it? Or his wannabe seat, which at that point was sort of separated off from the mainland, apparently.
Oh, was it?
A little bit, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know.
But so that just sort of sets the scene, because they're just the first. Hengist and Horsa are just the first. That same thing, more or less, plays out all sorts of ways. So Northumbria, north of the Humber, you've got like the Angles and Saxons that come into Anglia. Mm. East Anglia, and they call themselves the North Folk and the South Folk, as we get Norfolk and Suffolk from. The Middle Angles is the Midlands.
Sussex is the South Saxons. Wessex is the West Saxons.
Exactly.
It's not very complex, actually.
Yeah. One thing to mention, though, is that, they never did really, well, they never fully conquered the whole island. So it's a bit, it's a little bit simplistic, a little bit low resolution, but... you can say that all these new invaders from Germany are the English, comes from Angles. And you can say the people that were originally there are British or Britons.
Yes.
So again, people that really, really know their stuff will say, oh, that's very low resolution what you've just said there. which it is. I know it is.
Oh, it's incredible.
But we've got to, you know, we've got to draw a line somewhere. I mean, most of the historians just talk about the English and the British. Hmm. And of course, Arthur, for example, is a Briton.
Yes.
So we get that.
A little bit more detail. The Brythonic people, which are the for some reason, like, it's hard to know what is and isn't Celtic, to be honest. But like they share a great deal of culture and genetics with the people of Brittany, sort of the Northern French. When we say the Anglo-Saxons, what we actually mean is going from roughly sort of Friesland up around the sort of band in Germany, around to the Anglin River, which is where the Angles come from and get their name. And then, of course, you've got Jutes. And so that sort of band of barbarians, it seems that they all had very similar language, culture, and customs.
Oh, yes,
very
absolutely.
Closely related. Very, very similar.
Yeah.
They would have been able to speak to one another in their own native tongues and be understood. So essentially, they would not spoken different languages, they would just had weird accents to one another, like we have now, incidentally. And those people in some sort of, I don't know if it's an actual confederation or just some sort of agreement, just come over en masse, because it seems that it's ripe for the picking. The Romans are no longer here. It's a rich country. You know, isn't it better than Jutland? It's like, yes.
I was just going to say, Jutes comes from sort of Jutland, basically.
Yes.
And, one thing to say there is that possibly we think now, probably actually, they're being pushed from the east.
It's entirely
possible. All sorts of peoples pushing them from the east.
Quite probable, yeah.
And they're sort of semi-defended, semi-empty island they can go to westward.
What's going on in the with the Huns at this point, you know?
Right, well,
that's why the legions have been recalled, isn't it?
Yeah, because continental Europe is really in chaos. Yeah. I mean, really, really falling apart. Just seems like something approaching anarchy.
Yeah.
Where it's every man for himself almost.
Yeah.
Every homestead
every
for itself
tribe for
almost.
Themselves at the very least. So, yeah, so you can see why they would have been like, well, this just seems like a really sensible idea. You know, wouldn't that be useful?
And one thing just to make it a little bit more easy for us, but again, it's kind of low resolution, but is that the Jutes, the Angles, and the Saxons can sort of, if you want to, just sort of be collapsed into the Saxons.
Yeah.
Churchill wrote this. It's probably that before their general exodus from Schleswig-Holstein, the Saxons had virtually incorporated the other two strains.
Mm.
So that's a little bit glib to say that, but it's also kind of fair enough.
Yeah. I mean, when Charlemagne's, you know, going at the Saxons, I mean, what's that even mean? You know, it's a very broad term that they apply to just basically the people of that region, regardless of who they actually are. And it's like, okay, fine. Because Saxon is based on the weapon that they use, the Saax, which is a long dagger, which, you know, I'm sure is a useful weapon. But it's like, okay, so what does that actually mean? You know, did they actually identify themselves like that? I mean, maybe, you know, who knows, you know? Mm. Like, you know, we don't know. And so, but it's complex internetwork of tribes, you know, that all knew each other, spoke to each other, traded with one another, and fought with one another.
It'd be nice if there was like a Saxon sort of epic poem or something.
But no, they were
illiterate.
You don't have to be literate to have an epic poem, you know.
They just used the oral tradition.
But this is what Tolkien was writing Lord of the Rings for, because he's like, look, basically, the English don't have this epic poetic tradition that the Scandinavians and the Irish do and the Scots do. The English is just like this black hole of epic tradition, you know. And so Tolkien was just like, yeah, I'm just gonna write one.
I feel like that's what Geoffrey of Monmouth was doing.
Quite possibly.
We need our own
sort
of mythical founder type Theseus person.
Yeah.
In a sense.
It's quite possible, yeah.
But there's no doubt that the Angles and Saxons and the Jutes were they used main force. There's no question about that. Churchill says, their whole scheme of society was fundamentally sordid and vicious.
Okay, so Churchill, I think, is wrong on this. And I think that Tacitus's Germania is probably a more accurate representation of what their kind of society would have been like.
I feel like Tacitus has got the rosy tinted goggles on.
You think so?
Anything. Yeah.
Okay, maybe.
Because there's a bit, I was reading a bit about the Witan.
Mm-hmm.
And they certainly could, anyone could, or any adult man could stand up and shout what he thought and that sort of thing. and the king was sort of obliged to take it on board, but didn't have to, and some ruled without a Witan at all. Mm-hmm. Some were just sort of purely just sort of a military autocrat.
Well, it's informal. It's all quite informal. But
I mean, Bede paints the picture of some war, basically just warlords.
Yeah, they absolutely would have been warlords. That's true. But I think they would have been the inheritors of long custom. And so these customs do come with some quite strict social prescriptions. So, like, have we done Germania?
Yeah, we have done. Yeah.
So, I think that it's probably more complex than we're giving it credit for.
That's fair to say.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.